Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Grace Ann Walden, restaurant columnist for Marin Magazine. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Tony Bourdain, host of the popular Travel Channel show, No Reservations, chef, and author of Kitchen Confidential, and most recently, The Nasty Bits, a collection of his essays. In an era when there is a superstar on every corner, and so-called celebrity chefs on every channel, Tony Bourdain takes aim at the pompous and phony, writes on a knife's edge, and most refreshingly, tells the truth. If he hadn't emerged on the scene, the kitchen god would have had to invent him. It is my great pleasure, as a former line cook, now a journalist, to welcome Tony Bourdain.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. I don't live anywhere these days, and I don't really know what I do for a living. I change countries about every 10, 11 days. I travel 25 or 26 days out of the month, either to make television or to write about places or to promote the television or the writing and here or in other countries. So I'm homeless in the most wonderful way. Just a few years ago, when I wrote Kitchen Confidential, I was still working 12 to 14-hour shifts every day in a hot kitchen, standing around with the same sweaty guys in a tiny little submarine-sized space, telling the same jokes, listening to the same jokes. Subject matter in the kitchen is a fairly restricted. Not too many topics come up. And I thought that was what my life was going to be. I was, frankly, a very happy chef. Unlike most of my 30-year career, Leal, my last restaurant, was a wildly successful one. We were actually making money. The food was actually good. Things were going well, I thought. I wrote this little obnoxious memoir that I thought no one would read other than a few, you know, marginal line cooks in the New York tri-state area. And I thought I'd go right, I would amuse them and would go. I'd go right back to work. Well, flash forward a few years. 2 weeks ago, I was flying over the interior of Ghana in a military helicopter with both doors open, my foot on the skids, listening to the soundtrack of Apocalypse Now on my iPod. Life is sweet. Now, I don't fully understand why this happened. I gather that I am benefiting very much from this general trend towards glamorization of chefs, a new obsession with food, a new interest in restaurants as a form of entertainment, or possibly the fact that people just aren't having enough sex and, think and talk about food a lot lately. Whatever, it seems to be working out for me. But whatever it is I do, most of my time over the last few years has been spent in all over the world, often in some really amazing places, and I've come to know and break bread with some really incredible people. I've eaten with headhunters in Borneo, former Viet Cong in the Mekong Delta, Topnar and Bushmen in Africa, Russian gangsters in Moscow, and everybody's nice. I've been treated well. I've been the beneficiary of random acts of kindness from people all over the world. And I guess that's just what I want to talk about a little here before I take questions. And I hope, by the way, that there are some belligerent, pissed-off questions in this crowd. I've been very unkind to vegetarians and vegans and raw food activists. I've done everything I can to provoke you. I hope, in spite of the fact that you're not getting any animal protein, that you could summon the energy to give it back. And someone here has got a, you know, hostile Rachel Ray fans also might want to. You know, $40 a day, you know, sure, if you don't tip, you know. Tip, bitch. Which brings me to my thoughts on travel. Nothing horrifies me more than, well, other than $40 a day, than the thought of someone traveling this incredible world and not eating everything in sight. One of the problems that I have with veganism and vegetarianism is not, you know, whatever you choose to do in your own home, that's fine. How do you travel and turn your nose up to, you've already decided before you leave home, I reject it, I don't like it, I'm not going to try it. You're not making any friends in this world. It's rude. It's not respectful. I don't necessarily like all of the things that I eat on the road. Sitting with the Bushmen, watching them as they yank my warthog head in fur, you know, out of the ground. I'm not, frankly, looking forward to that meal. But I'm grateful that they're there and giving me their best. And I have found again and again that because I sit down with people first and eat plenty of whatever's offered, proudly offered, food being, of course, the purest expression of a culture, an identity, even a personality, a family. Because I do those things, accompanied by large amounts of the local beverage, all those other things open up for me. You never see people so without guile, so open as at the table. And once you've shared something as intimate as a meal, you tend to then be shown other things that you just ain't going to see from the tour bus, and more often than not, you're not going to see even had you met them under other circumstances. The Russians are not the most outgoing, friendly folks in the world until you get about this far down the vodka bottle, at which point it's all singing and I love you, man, and, you know, we're friends for life. Ditto, the Japanese, it's not the friendliest country in the world, but again, after some sake and karaoke and plenty of, yakitori and skewered chicken bits, you've got lifelong friends. I am very grateful always, always for what I've eaten and what I've seen and all the pinch-me moments that I have in my life, and that is directly related to the fact that I show up and I eat, what's offered. This has led to some comical moments, of course. The show, for instance, is shown all over the world. And anywhere where there's ethnic Chinese culture, Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong, and China, they've seen the show. And I think there's a general amusement. It's that goofy-looking white guy who really likes our food and eats all that, and eats some of, the crazier stuff. What this means is that when I go back, they're kind of waiting for me. It's like... Oh, so you think you've eaten weird, huh? Have you tried the fried scorpion? It's like, oh, penis again? Nothing makes your blood run cold more than someone coming to the table with a big grin and saying, oh, Mr. Bourdain, we have something very special for you. Or worse, this will make you strong, okay? Oh, man, break out the bear bile, And by the way, if you've never had bear bile, and I can save you, I can satisfy your curiosity. If you've ever been out till 5 in the morning drinking tequila and end up curled up in a fetal position on a cold bathroom floor, I know I have, you've pretty much had the bear bile experience. It has been a long, strange, and wonderful trip, and I cannot believe that a major network has given me a budget to go out and go anywhere I want in this world, pretty much say whatever I want, rip off all my favorite film directors once a week, and make a television show. I'm very grateful for that, and I hope to do it for a few more years to catch up with me, figure out what a scam it's been. Last, I just want to encourage you or stress again that when you travel, I know I'm going to be asked, someone's writing this question right down on the card right now, do you ever get sick? What about all that, some of that food you're eating, it's dirty, don't you ever get sick? All I can tell you is this, we have a betting pool on our show. My crew travel with me, they eat pretty much what I eat. On every show, we have a betting pool. Who's going to get sick and miss a day's work first? The person on the crew who gets sick every time first, the all-time winner, is our camera person, producer, Tracy, who every time she goes to the bathroom, she comes out, washes herself down with Purell, avoids anything that looks scary or dirty every time she gets sick, and it's always the breakfast buffet at the Hilton. Always. Please believe me, just because there's no refrigeration, the place looks dirty, and you don't know what part of the animal it is, that's not necessarily a bad thing. If you're in China or in Mexico and it's a nasty-looking place with a long line of locals out the door lining up to eat, pig head, chances are it's pretty good pig head. Otherwise, they wouldn't have 30 or 40 locals hanging out waiting to get in. It's worth trying. A big empty restaurant, the place that the concierge sends you, right? Where should I eat in Beijing, right? Oh, I have just a place for you. All the Americans love it. And you go in, and of course they do. There's tuna sandwich, they have spaghetti and meatballs, they have teriyaki chicken, they have a taco plate, all of them done horribly. How can you do all of those things well? You can't. The best places in the world, the best and most memorable meals for me are, one dish, one cook places. There's the duck guy or the chicken rice guy in Singapore. That's all they make. They made it. Dad made it. The granddad made it. They're pretty good at it by now. And if they're busy, of course, it means they're turning over their stuff. They don't need a refrigerator. If they need a refrigerator, that means they've got leftovers. If they've got leftovers, it means they're not making money. It's wasted money. So I urge you, this is a big, wide, beautiful world filled with lots of good stuff to eat and, more significantly, good people in it. And so eat without fear. On that note, I'd love to take some questions.
Great. Thank you, Anthony, for your comments. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Anthony Bourdain. And I love this question. It had to be the leader. You drink like a maniac, smoke constantly, and eat the most vile of foods. How are you still standing?
Because I eat red meat, cheese, tobacco, and liquor. It works for me. Essentially, every day I like to get up in the morning and Google Keith Richards. If he's still alive, I'm going to be okay.
On a more serious note, Whole Foods has just banned the sale of live lobsters and crab. And there's also chefs and others now declining to serve foie gras. Your thoughts on banned foods?
People are being sold into slavery, beaten to death, imprisoned, tortured, starving, dying of disease, and these numbnuts are worried about mollusk cruelty? some of them are unbelievable. The PETA thing, the foie gras thing. I think it's a win for the bad guys. I suggest you all enjoy your foie gras now. It's very unlikely that we'll see much more of it in the years to come. I think it's a terrible thing. It's one of the principal colors on the palate of the classically trained chef since Roman times. As the PETA people fully well know, if they really wanted to go after animal cruelty where it counts, they can go after the kernel and our insatiable desire for anything fried in batter and battery chickens. They know it's much worse, but they're not going to take on the kernel. It's much easier to go out to Sonoma and terrorize Laurent Manrique, one of your chefs. Little story, just so we know who we're talking about here. Laurent Manrique, made the mistake of opening a little gourmet shop, Sonoma Saveur. Some activist heroes broke into his shop at night, plugged up the toilet, threw acid over everything, flooded out his business and the business on both sides, terrorized his customers, keyed his car, made fake reservations, and here's my favorite, they slipped into his backyard at night while he was at work and videotaped his wife and infant son cuddling in his living room, sent him the videotape with a sinister, menacing voiceover. You know what? I don't think those people should be rewarded. And so I'm going to eat foie gras the rest of my life out of sheer spite.
Is there anything you have ever chosen not to eat or drink? If so, what was it?
I'm not eating a Cinnabon. Is that food? You know, Mom said never eat anything bigger than your head. On this, she was right.
Since you wrote the book, Kitchen Confidential, do you think the environment has gotten easier or harder for female chefs?
I think, unrelated entirely to Kitchen Confidential, through time, yes, things have gotten easier for women chefs. I really admire the women who came into the business and became chefs in the early 70s, back when it was like complete dinosaur era. But every year, I think, you know, every time there are women already working in the kitchen when other women come out of culinary school or enter the workplace, obviously that's a good thing. First of all, the level of discourse in the kitchen can only get better. You know, as we all know, you know, anytime you multiply the number of men standing around working together, the conversation declines in quality. And also, this is a mentoring business. Everyone, you learn through repetition, and there are no secrets. You know, the notion of the secret recipe is ridiculous. Chefs teach one person after another, one at a time, absolutely everything they know. So the fact that there are role models and veteran women in the kitchen in increasing numbers is only a good thing. And I think, it's certainly getting better and better and probably more the agreeable workplace. That said, I kind of like the fact that the conversation in kitchens is so utterly profane and politically incorrect. It is the last true meritocracy, where you are, no matter where you come from or what you say or what your predilections are or your national origin or your religion, you people who would never otherwise like each other or get along are thrown together in a high-pressure situation and judge each other based entirely on can they do the job. That's a beautiful and a liberating thing.
Great. What do you think are the current trends in cuisine? And this is a very broad question, so I've just come back from New York. Let's just talk maybe New York.
More casual. I think a lot of chefs in fine dining restaurants have been to Spain and experienced really good food served over a counter. All chefs have a fierce love for sushi, especially late night after work, accompanied by a lot of sake. And I think there's fine dining exhaustion. I think a lot of chefs are choosing to cook differently, and I think customers are getting tired of, you know, a long, you know, four-hour meal, formality, preposterous, sort of pretentiousness. I give an example in an article in this book where I'm sitting at, Charlie Trotter. No, Alain Ducasse in New York. There's a water sommelier. That's wrong. I don't want 12 different types of salt. I don't want to think while I'm eating. I just want to relax submissively and enjoy. Cooking is about control. Eating should be about, you know, just give me good stuff. I don't want to have to choose salts. So I think the move, a lot of chefs are abandoning their former style and serving high-quality food, more authentic food, in more casual environments. And I think that's a really positive trend.
I love this question. How hot are you?
Next question. I love this notion that chefs are sexy, okay? Because it must be, you know, it must be great. You go out with a chef, it must be great. Yeah, he stinks of smoked salmon. He's drunk all the time. He cheats. There's black pepper and beef fat under his fingernails. That's hot. And on his day off, he sleeps straight through. You know, all good.
Where did you eat last night?
Last night, an event at the Left Bank out in Larkspur. Unfortunately, a lot of cities I go to, you know, I'm in and out on events. It was a great meal, but I don't get to eat around at all the places that you know, people are going to make restaurant suggestions. It's like, I would love to, but I'm not going to make it. They really did a great meal there last night. Boudin noir and lamb's tongue. Good stuff.
My neck of the woods. My husband and I are both from New Jersey, and you and I are both from
Island
New Jersey.
Island of Enlightenment.
And saw the episode of No Reservations on New Jersey Cuisine. We were surprised that Taylor Ham was not included. Any comments on this delicacy that my friend described as Jersey Osso Buco? It's also a salt lick.
Yeah, I just, you know, missed it. You know, the problem when any time I go to a country and do a show, obviously I miss 99.99% of what's great about their country. I'm not even trying to do an authoritative overview of the show. I'm not an authority. I'm not a critic. I'm not even a reliable guide. It's a vicarious. I went. This is what it felt like, what it smelled like. I have the luxury of being honest, meaning, unlike the bobbleheads on Food Network, if I'm standing in front of a steam table full of gruel that clearly, you know, looks like bedpan, I will not say, hey, that's great. You know, I'm going to say, this sucks. I will also, you know, I will just miss things. What I focused on in the Jersey show was kind of symptomatic of what's going on in a lot of places in America where the food used to be very uninteresting. You're getting a lot of people from someplace else coming and bringing their food. In this case, a lot of Koreans and Japanese have transformed the New Jersey that I grew up in. So it's always that's something that I focus on and written about a lot when you in those large empty spaces between Olive Gardens in the Midwest. it's real nice finding a Vietnamese neighborhood. It's absolutely enlightening.
I have my own question. I've watched over the years sporadically the Food Network, and it seems to me that it's evolved away from teaching to being very cult of personality driven. Could you speak to that?
Well, I think it's a very sensible business model in that their focus groups have shown them that their audiences apparently don't want no foreigners on there, people who talk funny. They want to see barbecue shows. They want to see how candy is made. And they don't want trained chefs. They've said as much. They don't want trained chefs. They want to brand personalities, hopefully raising them from Petri dishes or cloning them. And they're looking at branded, friendly personalities that people will return to as a calming video, moving wallpaper. You know, does anyone actually, you know, see Sandra Lee and cook that food? I hope not, you know. Cheese whiz and Triscuits, feed your family. No. I think, you know, they keep their eye on the prize, which is more viewers, which they're getting, so it's working, and, you know, the action figure and merchandise.
Exactly.
It tells you all you need to know about Food Network, that Molto Mario it was canceled. You know, the smartest, best stand-up cooking show since Julia Child. Too smart for television. Horrifying.
And Sarah Moulton also.
Sarah Moulton, who helped build the network and, you know, unfortunately can actually cook, can't have that, you know.
Right.
It's all big heads now. Do you know that success on television is in many ways, it is found, phrenology is apparently very popular. because big head, successful on TV. It's the Giardia de Laurentiis syndrome.
This question from our audience really strikes a chord with me because it struck a chord with me when I read this part of your book. I thought your episode with the Inuit family was extraordinary. You seemed truly humbled while sitting in the kitchen there with the family and the seal carcass. Could you elaborate on that experience?
Perfect example of what, to all outward appearances, was a truly horrifying moment. Okay, I'm sitting on a kitchen floor with a group of people tearing apart a seal, you know, dripping blood. It was an intensely because of the people, because of this, you know, if you just see that in a vacuum, it's Night of the Living Dead. I had seen, however, the cold of that place, 1,000 miles in every direction, not a tree, nothing. I mean, 30 below zero, a people who for hundreds, if not thousands of years, have been surviving on the high fat and blubber content they need to live. And for them, this was an absolutely joyous occasion. I mean, I've never seen a family so close, you know, grandkids playing with their grandparents, all whipping out their own knives and tearing at this thing like a meat-filled pinata. But if someone can be beautiful with blood running off their chin, this was it. It was beautiful. It was truly heartwarming, and I felt very, very privileged to be there. Significantly, I thought I was going to get loads of mail on that episode, you know, angry, horrified mail. It was overwhelmingly positive. So I feel really good about that, and thank you for pointing that out.
I love the part where the woman grabbed some berries and put it in the blood and fat and gave it to you, and you said, it was delicious.
It was beautiful.
What do you think of Top Chef? Who do you think should have won?
I haven't seen it. I do watch Hell's Kitchen, though. I love that show. And absolutely, if you saw last season, I was rooting for Evil Mike all the way. He had everything going for him. He was manipulative, possibly borderline psychotic, backstabbing, evil, a little crazy, had good cooking skills, perfect chef material. I knew he'd go all the way.
Please comment on the huge portions some restaurants serve.
Yeah, is there anything more terrifying than going to those places about where it's with a good value, you know, so important? Like, did you see in Fargo, you know, good value.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, if it's good, it has to be draped over the side of the plate. The Denny's Grand Slam breakfast. What is it? Pancakes, bacon, sausage, 2 eggs, some, you know, hash browns. I mean, it's disgusting. You're not enjoying that after a few, as Thomas Keller's pointed out, after the first few bites, you're really not enjoying the flavor. And after a couple more bites, you're not really filling your stomach. You're filling some other empty spot. I mean, obviously, I'm disgusted by it, and I don't know that we should stop. But, you know, and there is definitely a time and a place for too much of a good thing. But what is it now? They're promoting the fourth meal, Taco Bell, I think?
Yes.
Fourth meal.
Yes.
Yeah, we need that. You know, go to Texas. You know, you can walk around all day in Texas and you'll never see anyone with a neck. You know, do we really need a fourth meal? I think not. It's unpatriotic in these difficult times. You know, I might have to leave the plane in a hurry. You know, I would prefer you not clog my exit chute. Thank you.
You're listening to the Commonwealth of California radio program with Anthony Bourdain. And there are exits. I'm going to put this all together in one question because I have an interest in it, too. What are your thoughts on the trend that really seems to be organic is getting more and more popular? And also, if you could comment on this eat locally. I personally don't want to give up French cheese, but that's just me. That trend also.
Okay, I think the organics thing, I don't care about the ideology, and I don't personally care whether my tomato is organically grown or grown in a greenhouse. I will serve whichever one is better. The one that tastes better is the one I'm serving. I don't think I owe you a guarantee of absolute purity or an impeccable bloodline. And frankly, when I'm eating in a restaurant, I really don't want the waiter to talk for 10 minutes about where my tomato came from, who grew it, you know, from what hippie grew it. I don't care. I'm in the pleasure business. My responsibility, personally, I feel this way, my personal responsibility ends with, presumably, you should have a pleasurable experience at the table, and I would like it if I manage to improve the likelihood that you get laid after dinner. Beyond that, my responsibility ends. I think, however, that the organics thing is really good. Anything that highlights and encourages better quality, more care, more variety and higher expectations in the dining public and among chefs and food buyers is a good thing. And what this has done has allowed us choices that we didn't have before. I mean, we were down to like two or three types of apples in this country. So anything that brings back, that the golden era of produce and animals, for that matter, I'm all for. Eating regionally, eating locally. Again, I admire it. There are certain chefs I know who will only serve food from that area. I dig what they're doing. I'm just, I call it in the book, there's the Crips versus the Bloods. The Bloods are de terroir, cooking locally, regionally. Alice Waters would be a classic example of a Blood. The Crips are, I don't care where it comes from. If it's good, I want it. I'm into fusion or whatever. I'm glad they're there, the people who are concentrating on regional, because, again, raises expectations, more pride and attention paid to particular areas. But me, if it's, I'm not doing without Otoro tuna flown in from Tsukiji, and I'm not getting that in the Hudson Valley. Yeah.
And what about the slow food movement?
Again, a really positive thing. It celebrates... Anyone who celebrates, helps, protects, and promotes some little business that wants to do salami or cured meat or mortadella or cheese or any of those things the old way, the traditional way. Before we thought that all cheese was square and in a natural orange hue, is a good thing. Anyone who wants to bring back, heritage animals... or improve the quality. The boutique pig is a perfect example. Chefs decided, pork, the other white meat, it was promoted for years because as the fatless alternative to steak, which is exactly what it shouldn't be. I will quote the greatest gastronome and thinker who ever lived, Homer Simpson. The pig is a magical animal. It is a mosaic of many textures and flavors. And a chef started saying, I want my pigs raised this way. I want them with more fat. I want different varieties. And I think all of those things, everything that falls under the rather ungainly umbrella of slow food is a win for the good guys.
Thank you. What do you think of the Iron Chef? And would you ever go on that show?
It's a freak show, but... Anytime I see Mario, beaten up on Bobby Flay, I'm happy. I get angry watching it because I just say it's a waste of the awesome genius of Mario Batali.
Who is your favorite and least favorite cooking celebrity?
Favorite, obviously, Mario. For sure. He used the bully pulpit of celebrity to get America to eat things they never would have eaten a few years ago. When he opened Babbo, he was a big star on TV. He could have opened up, Mario's Spaghetti Factory in malls across America, and everybody would have paid $22 for, a 22-cent order of linguine pomodoro, and he could have cashed out. Instead, he opens up restaurants that sell, like, brains and kidneys and hooves and snouts and all these oily little fishes, all these wonderful traditional Italian ingredients, using that fame to get people to eat the way he feels they should eat, which is to say, eat the things that he loves and knows and believes to be good. I really admire that. I think the apex of pure evil would be Sandra Lee, who, is telling you essentially that really all you need to do to eat well and feed your family is open a can and squirt Cheese Whiz on it. And I think... it's wrong, it's evil, and it's disgusting.
I agree. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Anthony Bourdain.
Think the Food Network will have me back?
Of all the offal you have eaten, what was your favorite part and how was it prepared?
All right, my favorite dish on earth. I'm getting the electric chair tomorrow. I'm eating roasted bone marrow with a little toasted French bread, a couple of slices of French bread, some sea salt. That is just butter from God. I'm very fond of sweetbreads, the thymus gland. A good rabbit kidney is fantastic.
Delicious.
tail. Stop me anytime. I encourage everyone to get an incredible book, kind of the Bible of offal and pork. A book by the sort of the Obi-Wan Kenobi of chefs these days, Fergus Henderson, a British chef, and his book is called The Whole Beast, and it's traditional, old school British cooking, and it is maybe the most influential cookbook in the world right now. Every chef in the world wants his restaurant serving, believe it or not, traditional country British food, a lot of it the nasty bits.
Another part of your career, of course, when you, I mean, you were a cook writing mysteries when you began. And someone has a question. When is the movie Bone in the Throat going to come out?
It's great. Hollywood's great. They give me money every year to not make a crappy movie out of my book. I have no idea. You know, one thing I've learned is that I should never care. You don't want to start believing, you know, you can't start drinking the Kool-Aid when Hollywood calls. You know, they'll tell you, oh yeah, it's going to be, you know, we're going to make a movie of Kitchen Confidential, and David Fincher's going to direct, and Brad Pitt's in it. Translation, it's a Hasselhoff vehicle, and it's about a chef and a mystery-solving dog, and it takes place in Malibu. So I have no idea.
Have you been approached and how many times to start your own line of products, a la Paul Newman, or I wouldn't say Paul Newman, but some celebrity chef, Emeril?
I've been offered his cookware is pretty good. Actually, it's good quality stuff. I've been offered every variety of endorsing products and starting a product line, opening restaurants. It's a quality of life issue. It's not like I have any ethics. I don't. I'd sell out in a hot second. I'm having fun. Things are going well. Do I need that much mail? It's embarrassing. I don't want to look into the bathroom mirror in the morning and say, hey, it's that Imodium guy from TV. That being said, once they cancel the show, maybe the next book doesn't so well, maybe then it will be Suntory time.
So we're back to our original premise, having to do with being hot. What foods get you in the mood? He's speechless.
I stick with the classics. Liquor. She looks great. And I think she likes me. Sushi. Good otoro, uni, that's good stuff. Caviar, classic,
What are a few of your favorite restaurants in the U.S., including San Francisco, if possible?
Best white tablecloth fine dining restaurant in the country and possibly the world, French Laundry. Best. Masa in New York. If you don't know, it's the most expensive restaurant in America. It's a 9-seat sushi bar, 2 tables. The chef feeds you everything personally. No menu, no glassware, no nonsense, just the most unbelievable, ethereal, pornographic fish you've ever seen in your life. It served over a hinoki wood bar that glows this supernatural butter yellow. You just want to curl up on the thing and go to sleep. I went with the chef of Le Bernardin, who another restaurant that I would say, think is a great favorite restaurant. And during the meal, this is a guy who knows his seafood, and we're sitting there eating $300 a pound tuna. That's 300 pound wholesale. And I hear Eric next to me going, oh, yeah, baby. Oh, man, that's good. That's a favorite. Barney Greengrass, the Sturgeon King in New York. Swanee's Oyster Depot here. Au Pied Cochon in Montreal. Fergus Henderson's Place St. John in London. Arzac in San Sebastian. A lot of good stuff out there. Lupa in New York.
El Bulli.
Good luck getting in. Another book you might want if you the ultimate foodie book to have on your cocktail table, the awesome $350 12-pound El Bulli cookbook. I don't know a single professional who would ever attempt to cook any of those recipes, but it is a thing of wonder, and if you want to see how people will be cooking in 50 years, this is a glimpse into the future. That's an incredible experience. I'm very skeptical of molecular gastronomy and science class food, as it's referred to, but, you know, El Bulli, you know, he does it right. It's a fantastic experience if you ever get a chance.
Well, aside from the meal you talked about earlier, someone said this is your last meal. What would you choose to eat? Can you go beyond the
Bone marrow. Would be
okay.
Number one. Otoro tuna.
Right.
You know, made by Masa on some warm, crumbly, grown in Japan rice with his own toasted nori and absolutely fresh, top quality wasabi. I would die happy.
This participant says, I just want to thank you. I recently did a gourmet tour of Vietnam, and my decision to go was predominantly because of she's saying it was the incredible experience of her life and truly changed me. Now, I heard, because I happened to meet your agent while I was having lunch in New York at Avoce, which I recommend highly, and she said, your next book is going to be about Vietnam.
I'm moving there in a couple of years, I planned. First of all, I find Vietnam, I'm very happy to hear that. It is the most enchanted and enchanting place I've ever been. I have never been anywhere where there is more great food readily available, where there are more proud cooks just coming at you from everywhere. Total strangers who will approach you and say, you know, let me feed you what's good. This is how good we've got it. They're passionate eaters. It's an incredibly beautiful country. I plan to move there as soon as if they ever cancel this damn show. I signed a book contract to go to Vietnam, live there for a year, 2 years, 3 years, maybe I don't know how long, and I'll write about it. I love it. It's pheromonic. You know, I'm asked a lot, why Vietnam and not, you know, another country? You know, why is that special for you? And I often say, you know, how do you describe why you fell in love with somebody, you know, for the first time? It's, you know, because she's brilliant, she's beautiful, she's funny, she can, you know, take apart a, you know, 67 Mustang and reassemble it to factory specs. All of those things may be true, but that's not why, you know? It's something else, and I hope to spend a lot of time figuring it out.
You've been just about everywhere in the world. What is the scariest situation you've been in?
Rolling an ATV over myself, an all-terrain vehicle over myself in New Zealand. I was high up on a dune, and it started to roll over on me. And, in fact, I went under the thing once and then twice. And when I saw that thing coming down on me again, it was discouraging. I was going to say, northwestern Cambodia, sort of the Khmer Rouge retirement village of Pai Lin. It's very heavily landmined on the way there. It's not very friendly. But, you know, the most terrifying thing ever was getting a massage in Uzbekistan. It's a traditional Arab-style hammam where you're basically, you know, scrubbed and then, you know, bent into positions that God did not intend you to. And, of course, my crew is filming this. And it was so painful. I mean, so horribly painful. It was like Midnight Express. You know, I'm laying on this big rock with my face in a sweat rag. I'm getting rear-mounted by a guy in a Speedo, and who's breaking, pulling every bone in my body out of its socket. And it was so painful that I was completely oblivious to the sexual humiliation I was going through, and the fact that I was being filmed. I just didn't want to scream. That was it. I really thought, I'm not recovering from this, you know?
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Anthony Bourdain. How do you feel about Alton Brown's style of teaching or his show?
He's a hyperactive little guy, isn't he? I think it's informative. I don't care how knowledge is imparted. If you walk away from an experience smarter, it's a good thing. Who cares why people first ate sushi in America? Maybe the most important tipping point in American gastronomic history was when Americans decided hey, raw fish isn't disgusting. It's good and something I want. Why did we eat sushi for the first time? It looked cool. A friend told us everybody's doing it. You read, you know, you saw Shogun or something. It doesn't matter. When we started eating it, all boats lifted. You know, the stuff at the fish market, which was before it was good enough, it wasn't good enough anymore. French chefs, Italian chefs could start serving varieties of seafood that they never could have sold their customers. So he's good for the world. I think it's an unusually informative show, The Good Eats.
Didn't you get into something dishy with him on Eat Gullet?
Yeah, I know. I felt I think I'd waved at him at the James Beard Awards, and he blew by me. But I heard back from him that, you know, he was, you know, high on ether or something. No, he didn't intend. You know, it was an imagined slight. You know, no bad blood between us.
Okay, that's good.
I kid.
Do you think culinary school is essential, or can someone still work their way up to a head chef position? When I was cooking, I mean, there were all these self-taught cooks.
Yeah.
And then after a while, it became everybody came out of the CIA or CCA. What do you think about that?
Well, right now, you know, you go to Ducasse in Paris, you go to El Bulli in Spain, you're tripping over kids from all over the world. This has become so. Who's entering the workplace now at the top level? If the future chefs, more often than not, have had a culinary education. So it is definitely a plus. I would recommend it. That said, you know, if you're changing careers or you're young and your parents are ponying up a lot of money to send you to culinary school, I urge you to first go work in a real busy restaurant as a prep cook, as a dishwasher for a week, for a few weeks or months. Because at the end of that period, my friends, you will know whether you want to be in the restaurant business. I can't tell you how many times in my life I've seen, you know, people who've left perfectly good jobs to fulfill their dream of being a professional cook. They've gone to cooking school. Then they show up in my restaurant to work as externs or as commis. You know, after a week and a half, I'll look across the line one busy Saturday night, and I'll look into their face, and in their eyes, I will see the dream die. You know, people are mean to me. It's hot in here. I don't like peeling shallots for 8 hours. You know, what's a baboso? You know.
I'd like to comment on one part of your book that I just loved, and that was where you talked about who's really cooking the food, and that's so true in the Bay Area. You know, viva Mexico, viva, you know, El Salvador, the Hispanic cooks.
You know, it's something, to me, whatever your feelings on immigration policy are, and we can have a whole variety of them, at least let us begin the conversation by being honest about who is doing the cooking in this country, okay? And that's anywhere from 17% to 70% of the workforce in many major cities are Latino, of varying legal statuses. So it is sickening and sick-making to me to stand, at the James Beard Awards, an organization a few years back, an organization that claims to celebrate and love the restaurant business and the people who work in it, and look out at this vast mob of you know, white people, because that's not who's cooking. So it's something of a pet issue to me, and I would like to I'd like to see that. You know, we're not talking more often than not, increasingly in New York. It's not like I'm hiring illegal Mexican labor because they're cheap. It long ago became a character issue. It's chefs like me who looked around, I need a sauté cook, and I look over at my dish station at a guy who's been there 8 years showing up on time and doing solid work and then learning the salad station. I'm thinking, am I going to get some punk kid out of cooking school who's going to either freak out or get bored or decide to go skiing for 6 months? Or I'm going to go with a guy, you know, who's used to irony, who's used to an unfair world, who is used to being responsible for people, who comes from a culture where food is important. You know what? I'm going with my dishwasher. He's a better investment of my time to teach and to mentor. And I would love to see, you know, all of the people who helped me and mentored me along the way, because the strongest guy in the kitchen in a new kitchen was always a Mexican or an Ecuadorian guy. Yeah, I'd like to see them get some respect in this world.
Do you think they will rise?
I think there's a glass ceiling. You know, where people who've been running kitchens for quite a long time, there is a hesitancy. to run a fancy French restaurant charging big prices and have a mestizo-looking cook with a Latino name walking around your dining room. It doesn't fit in with the sort of pompous and largely bogus image of that we've built up, and I think chefs are as guilty of it, and I'm guilty of it. In order to sell our food, command those prices, and keep the business going, there has been a over-romanticized notion that it's some, you know, it's a French guy.
Some tortured artist.
A tortured artist, when in fact it's a Mexican prison gang.
Right. Where have you not yet been in the world that you would like to go?
I could spend the rest of my life making television in China. I've been to Beijing and I've been to Sichuan province. There's so much more. I haven't been to Madagascar, Argentina, Laos, Myanmar. Big world, a lot of places left to go.
Fantastic. Someone wants to know, do you follow recipes?
I look at the pictures and cookbooks before stealing them and adapting them. Not really. It's one of the problems. It's why a lot of chefs really hate the idea of they don't like baking because you have to follow a recipe. It's very, very precise. A lot of chefs like myself, we like to be instinctive. Our recipes are often a little of this, a little of that,
Do you have some favorite ingredients you like to play around with? Or does that change?
Butter,
over time?
Can't live without it. Can't believe it's not butter. Yes, I can. Duck fat, great stuff. Cooking fish in duck fat is fantastic. Cooking French fries in duck fat, will give you a product that's unbelievable. Fundamental, nothing really wacky. I'm an old school French cook. I'm not famous for any innovative, great leap forward in cooking. To me, it all comes down to butter, pork fat, duck fat. It's pretty much what I eat every day. And what I hate, though, a vile substance that must be removed from all restaurants, or you should at least apply for a license to get it, truffle oil. Most overused, I think Jonathan Gold, the food writer, called it the ketchup of the middle classes. truffle oil doesn't make it better. It has almost nothing to do with truffles. We will have all forgotten the glory that is a real truffle because we've been so our palates have been so blown out by this foul stuff. So, please.
When the mashed potatoes reek of it.
It would be great if you could go into restaurants and people would just start saying, some people say no butter, no truffle oil. You would be doing good for the world.
There's been media coverage of so-called speakeasy restaurants in private homes. Do you know about these, and would you like to go to one or cover it in your writing?
I just went to one in Seattle. It's a floating restaurant operation that's held at a different place each week. Potential customers are first, interrogated as to their degree of coolness, and then are invited to attend. I think it's a good idea. I think anything that allows young cooks and chefs to kind of break out of the restaurant. The problem with cooking is that you've got to do it in a restaurant, a business that is almost, certainly the majority of the time, doomed to fail. So any way that cooks have yet another venue to stretch and people can eat well, especially if, you're eating illegal stuff like unpasteurized raw milk cheeses have been bootlegged in from France or crunchy little ortolan game birds that are technically illegal or fugu. What's bad about that? I had a very good meal in Seattle at one of these things, and it was a bunch of very motivated, really eager young kids, extraordinarily high quality. I think it's a good thing.
How do you inspire a bored cook? I would say, how did you motivate your cooks when you were full-time at Les Halles?
I went with the British Navy model of rum, buggery, and the lash. Carrot and stick. Today you did good. Free drinks. Today you did bad. You get brunch shift.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Anthony Bourdain. Work-wise, what gives you the most satisfaction?
When I can get the dining public, even if it's only a few of them, to eat something that I know is difficult. That, like, at Layal, we have a lot of regular lunch customers. You know, they're there 4 or 5 times a week. And after they've eaten the same thing, sometimes they'll go for one of the more difficult specials. And what we used to put on, something like Tête de Veau, very classic, very old school dinosaur era French, but it's basically, you know, a calf's head rolled up with its tongue and thymus gland and served with a sauce gribiche. That or pied cochon, pig's feet, again, about as old school French as you can get, or, you know, a nice wet boudin noir. I love those things, but I know it's going to be, under ordinary circumstances, it's difficult to get someone who's never had it before to, you know, hey, today, try the pig's feet. Tough. When I can get people to do that and they like it, that's I just feel like we've made like a tiny step towards enlightenment. You know, it makes me feel better. It's a win.
We've had several questions on how do you stay thin?
The smooth, clean taste of tobacco. And I understand they make you cool in school. Laramie, the cigarettes of chefs everywhere.
What country surprised you the most? And I don't know the rest. What country surprised you the most?
I knew the food was going to be really good in Peru, in Lima in particular. Blown away by the food in Peru. Really modern, really excellent. The old traditional stuff, the ceviches were fantastic, and the new kind of semi, you know, Japanese, Peruvian fusion stuff, also really exciting. I even like the guinea pig, the traditional guinea pig thing they do there, the cui.
How do they cook the guinea pig?
Roast. I mean, it's, you know, nice guinea pig, pap, you know, zip.
Wrapped in bacon?
Yeah, I mean, every farmhouse in, you know, up in the mountains in rural Peru, they've been doing this for, you know, since before the Incas. You know, it's very, you know, pretty primitive stuff, herb inside, rub in spices, roast over open fire. The food in Ghana was a real surprise. Very, really interesting mix of spices, really good, very, very sophisticated soups and stews. And Indonesia, I knew the food in Indonesia was going to be good. I had no idea how good. Best pig ever. Just incredible. They do this whole roasted pig in Bali where they constantly, as they slowly turn it over the fire, they're mopping it with coconut water so it gets crispy and caramelized. Pig.
We need one of those on our corner. Besides food and drink, what else do you love? It says something here about women, but I don't know if I should go into that.
You know, if you don't like sex, you can't cook well. And I think it goes the other way, too. You know, there's a famous chef in the Midwest who I refer to often as, you know, I ate his food. And I said, this guy cooks like a guy who's never been properly laid in his life. I like music. I think the same is true of music. If you don't like music, how can you cook, you know, some kind of music? Movies, books. I grew up in a house filled with books and music, where movies were important. And I think that, you know, because my parents were like that and I grew up in that kind of environment, you know, that's made me, for better or worse, what I am. You know, those are all passions. You know, and I like sitting on a beach and drinking beer if I can, you know, if I have the time. That's, I like to stay still, pile of books, and, you know, risk skin cancer while drinking heavily in direct sunlight.
What music do you cook to?
During the prep period, I like, you know, Curtis Mayfield, early Curtis Mayfield, Isaac Hayes, you know, Parliament Funkadelic. You know, I like, you know, pre-disco, Motown and funk. During cooking, I kind of, it's a little discordant. After work, or as soon as I finish cooking or it's winding down, I'm cleaning up the Ramones, greatest band ever. Yeah. You know, mid-70s, you know, New York punk is, exactly. You know, makes me very happy.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's only time for one last question. So, in the United States, what's your favorite city?
What's my favorite city? I'm a New Yorker.
All the way.
I mean, you know, I don't know whether I'll live in New York for the rest of my life, but you know, I'll always look at the world, you know, not just as a New Yorker, but as a, you know, a New York cook and chef. You spend 30 years standing on your feet in a New York kitchen. That's who you are for the duration. Yeah, I'm sticking with New York. Love it here, but come
absolutely.
On. Thank you.
Our thanks to Anthony Bourdain, host of the popular Travel Channel show No Reservations, chef and author of Kitchen Confidential, and most recently, The Nasty Bits, Collected Varietal Cuts, Usable Trims, Scraps and Bones, for his comments today and all his good humor. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Grace Ann Walden, restaurant columnist for Marin Magazine. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.